Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Good to have you here. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik, and this is Red Eyes Radio, based out of Sweden, Scandinavia. On our websites, redeyescreations.com and redeyesmembers.com, you can find much more on all the topics that we find to be among the most important and interesting at this time. We cover a lot of topics, interviews, research, opinion, and analysis. It's all right there. We're going to continue on the situation on the Ukraine today. We have 1 hour with political thinker, internet columnist, and writer Israel Shamir ahead of us to specifically talk about much of what has been going on in the last couple of months in the Ukraine. Shamir was with us a couple of years ago, by the way, when we did our series on Zionism and multiculturalism. We're going to talk about the strange cooperations between the various interest groups and factions today. We'll talk about who is pulling the strings behind the scenes, and of course how the Ukraine has been used in the bigger geopolitical chess game. Also, by the way, don't miss our other 1 hour with Paul Craig Roberts on the same topic that we did just before this one. Lots to talk about, so let's get started. Welcome, Israel Shamir. Good to have you with us again. Thanks for coming on. Now, we only have a short segment here with you, so I suggest we get started right away. I wanted to talk more, obviously, about the coup in Kiev and the recent battles that we've seen, the kind of the proxy war that has been going on here in terms of fighting with Russia as well. From your analysis, Israel, who is behind it and where is this going to lead?
I see it more or less as a struggle against American hegemony. As I see it, in 1945, the Soviet Union and the United States divided the world. And in 1991, the Soviet Union went down and released whatever they had. But the United States did not release what they have, and they build up an attempt of total world dominance. That's something that nobody ever had. And that is something that was in the process of being built up. Now, Russia in 1991 was very, very weak. It was practically non-existent as a state. And Americans forgot about it. They had other things to do, other beans to fry. They went to Middle East, they went to Central Asia, to all kind of places. And eventually, Russia succeeded to cheer up under Putin. They succeeded to rebuild their own condition, and then they began to confront the United States and began to propose a different model, a model of non-hegemony, or that nobody rules the world, that the world is free. I don't know how many of our audience would remember it, but in 2007, the Russians blocked American-British attempt to take over Zimbabwe, to take over Burma. And that was actually the beginning of this sort of slow confrontation. And then last year, the Russians, together with Chinese, blocked an American attempt to destroy Syria.
Right.
And obviously, Americans were very, very upset about it. Until now, they got used already to the fact that they go wherever they want and they achieve whatever they want. And that's why, as a response to Syria, they attacked in Egypt, Ukraine. The Ukrainian coup, we know who arranged it. It was arranged by Victoria Nuland.
That's right.
That's kind of, the same woman that said, fuck the EU, as we know, in the recorded conversation.
Yeah.
She was one of the American representatives who arranged the coup. But obviously, everybody, including President Obama, were involved in it. They all called their then president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, and demanded from him to resist and to stop resistance, not to confront the violent elements which attacked his government. And he was a very, very weak person, so he actually agreed to it. That was very interesting thing for us because it was not that long time ago. I mean, we all probably remember that in February, when there were so much trouble in Kyiv in those days, we heard every time that it's forbidden for a government to shoot at the demonstrators, that it's forbidden to employ force. But now the government of Kyiv, which is not a real government, but something arranged by the Americans, shoots and kills people by dozens every day. And nobody objects. They say, well, that's how it should be. The government should rule. And if they have to kill somebody, let them kill. So in other way, that is obviously very interesting what happens in Ukraine now. And Americans succeeded to install their own government. For a Swedish radio, I would say it's very interesting to think about it in terms of Bildt, of Carl Bildt.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He was a very, very influential player on this side, on the American side. And well, we have some elections tomorrow in Sweden, right? Into Europarlament or something like that. But, you know, it doesn't matter whom you would choose. On any elections, Carl Bildt will remain in power. There are so many people who are arguing that the Swedish king has too much power or too little power,
right,
whether you need a king in Sweden. But nobody discusses whether you need Carl Bildt because he is inbuilt into a Swedish political fabric. And he began his career as a man connected with American intelligence, and he remained one of the strongest pro-American forces in Europe.
Well, exactly. He's a prominent Bilderberger as well. We have that upcoming in Denmark here in later this month, basically. And the double standard here is obviously amazing. If you compare what happened, for example, in Libya and the treatment there, that how the government came in because of the fact what the government were doing and whatnot. But then in this case with Ukraine, the attitude is completely different. Here they have free rein. In fact, they are willing to work together with anybody to get their goals achieved in this regard. Now, tell us a little bit more why it's important to control Ukraine in this way as well. This is a proxy war with Russia, obviously, but the Russia don't at all represent the same political ideology as they did back when there was the Cold War, right? It's a very different Russia today. So what is the battle over in this regard?
Yes, that's very true. Once we saw that the Cold War was because of the difference between capitalist and communist attitude. But now we see it's really, we kind of a little bit, we misjudged it. Maybe they do not care whether it's communism or not. Maybe what they really care about is whether it's all theirs or not. By they, I mean some sort of setup which rules the United States. In England, which is obviously very strongly connected to Israel, that we see this strange Israeli-American connection, which is beyond whatever normal politics can explain. And the people that they succeeded to implant in all kinds of places all over the world. So they have some peculiar setup, which some people tend to call the world government or whatever. Anyway, they want to have total dominance all over the world. And that is the thing. Ukraine is a very nice country. I personally very fond of Ukraine. Visited it many times. I kind of come there every year for a few times just to see how things are. People are quite pleasant and friendly. But the problem is like that with Ukraine. In 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, Ukraine was the wealthiest part of the Soviet Union, more wealthy than Russia, much more wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, in the year 2000, Putin came to power, and he succeeded to stop this robbery that the oligarchs, the tycoons of Russia, were engaged. In Ukraine, nobody stopped the tycoons. And they stole everything that could be stolen. That is quite amazing that it's a country where nobody stopped rich people from stealing everything they could. So they brought the country, obviously, to a very, very difficult situation. And that was one of their problems. Another their problem was some peculiar nationalism, which is, well, it's, let's say, if we speak about Sweden, it would be like building up Skåne nationalism, which, yes, it exists. We know that Skåne nationalism exists. But whether it is, does it exist to such an extent that Skåne would like to break off and to become a basis for attacks on Sweden, probably the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was 500 years ago, but not nowadays.
Right. This is the southern part of Sweden, its own kind of landscape, we call it, or like a bigger area. So that's what Israel is talking about here, for those who don't know. But yeah, go ahead, Israel.
Yes, yes. Now Ukraine, which is obviously, was an organic part of Russia for hundreds of years, allows to whoever stays there to attack Russia proper and destroy it in a very, very short time. No Russian defense, anti-missile defense or any other defense would be able to withstand an attack from Ukraine. It's a bit too close, too nearby. So a NATO takeover of Ukraine would trigger all-out Third World War, nuclear war, and probably destruction of mankind. Why so? Because Russians would be forced to make a very, very hard choice whether they will go down or whether they will go down pulling the world with them. And, you know, it's very possible that they would say, if we're being pushed, well, we can go down with a big bang then as well.
Right. Is there any risk of that as the scenario looks right now, do you think?
Well, it's not impossible, but again, it's not the last moment yet. Things are still can be changed. Russia doesn't really insist on owning or possessing or controlling Ukraine. It basically would be agree to any Ukraine that has no foreign armed forces in it.
Yeah.
So as long as foreign troops do not come into it, Russia could be quite indifferent, you know, to whatever happens there.
Right. Right.
From this point of view, it's not very, very kind of important. But the point is that Ukraine now is falling apart.
Right.
Because in order to remove the legitimate president, Mr. Yanukovych, the Americans decided to mobilize far right. And somebody like football fans of England, something like Sveriges Demokraterna, if we speak about Sweden. Some very, very extreme elements.
Well, I want people to know this as well. I want to mention this before we carry on here. In the West, whenever a nationalist group shows their head, if we look at the treatment in the media, obviously they demonize them as that they're the devil incarnate. But in the case here of Ukraine, it seems that the West, in this regard, they're willing to work with anybody in order to push through their agenda. They're obviously using these groups as a kind of a bulwark, right, to try to force out the Russian presence on the streets, etc., quell any kind of opposition to how they seek to do things. So that speaks a lot about the double standard that those who seek to take power in Ukraine actually holds, and their willingness to cross any of these so-called boundaries to be able to achieve those goals, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. But that is actually something that the Americans are doing everywhere.
Sure.
In Syria, you know, in Syria, they aligned themselves with Al-Qaeda.
That's right.
10 years ago, we were told that Al-Qaeda is the worst, and that everybody should unite to crush Al-Qaeda. And then, after all, they started to pay money to Al-Qaeda and support Al-Qaeda in its attempt to take over Syria. So, you know, they basically ally with whoever there is. They have no worry about allying with Nazis, with Muslim extremists. Doesn't matter.
So it's not about the interests of these groups, really, or the affiliations. It's about working with whom you ever can work with in order to achieve your goals. It's no ideology behind this. It's just a power grab, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. But then, you know, they also think that after the first step, after taking the power, there will be also enough time to kill off these groups. And that is also true.
Yeah.
We see that whenever they succeed, they use such extreme groups in order to achieve what they want. But then those groups are usually being killed off.
Exactly. We saw the same in that happened in Russia under the when the Soviets came in as well, that some of the hard, staunchest revolutionaries were afterwards actually purged and killed and taken out. Does not the people in Ukraine, these so-called nationalist groups, usually have a lot of young kids? They're obviously, I mean, I was thinking about, are they paid for? Are they getting money to do this? I mean, they're not smart enough to see through that they're being used here, correct?
Well, yes, some of them, their leaders, they are obviously after some power. They hope they can get power. And one of the leading men in that is Dmitry Yarosh, or Dmitro Yarosh, they say Ukrainian style. That is, well, some sort of gangster and the head of the neo-Nazi football team group of fans. And they are the most willing to fight. They are basically like football hooligans you can see anywhere, with like skinheads or whatever. But here they got armed, they got equipment, they got permission to do whatever they can. And they started to kill people quite a lot nowadays, mainly in eastern Ukraine. That's quite amazing how much they succeeded to do. Now, I was told by some acquaintances in Ukraine that Mr. Yarosh was offered $10 million by Americans to jump off, to get off.
Wow.
They say kind of, you know, we had enough of you. You kind of caused too much trouble. Take $10 million, go and enjoy yourself. Well, he laughed at it also.
Oh, boy. Jeez.
Because he
wanted to see... He wanted to keep going, and he actually this is what I'm amazed about at how these people, because if we look at the breakdown of what happened between, for example, Victoria, you know, Nuland, and then of course we have her husband Robert Kagan, who's a prominent member on you know, CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, a co-founder of the Project for the New American Century, and then you had a number of other people coming in, like the Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, right?
Yes,
they are Jewish, right? And so they're working together with neo-Nazis to get a power grab in Ukraine? What is going on here? This is weird, right?
This is very interesting thing that you touched. Very interesting. The point is that this sort of neo-Nazis are not similar to old Nazis. The old Nazis didn't like Jews, not because Jews have peculiar noses. They didn't like Jews because the Jews were connected to bankers.
Right.
You know, they were real kind of Nazis proper of those old days. They were against financial capital. You know, nowadays not many people remember it because all those things are very much demonized. But basically the difference between Reds and the Browns, between the communists and the Nazis in those days was that the communists were, first of all, against plant owners, factory owners, and the Nazis were against financial capital. They believed that they can, and from this point of view, Sweden is obviously something very interesting because of its special arrangement of 1930s when they decided to make peace between manufacturers and the workers. And that is one of those kind of, let's say, Nazi ideas. But the idea of destroying bankers, that was an idea of Nazis, and that was connected with anti-Jewish tendency. Nowadays, there is a new breed of Nazis. These new Nazis, they are not against Jews at all. And that is very interesting. I don't know. Just for fun, obviously, I said sometimes that they are artificially bred in the CIA laboratories, something like that. Do you remember maybe Anders Breivik in Norway?
Sure.
Yes, that is a typical representative of those new Nazis, because he is proper Nazi, no doubt about that. But all his hatred is towards Muslims. And as for Israel and for Jews, he has only positive emotions.
Yeah, very, very bizarre and interesting if you look at actually who's behind the immigration into Sweden and stuff like that. We have people like Barbara Spector, right? So there's a disconnect here of people who do not understand the full context of who's pulling the strings. That's how I see it anyway. And if they would do a little bit more research of actually realizing who's trying to reform Europe, they would actually hopefully open their eyes and realize that it's a bigger plot than just, you know, this one-sided view that they have, you know?
Yes, they would. But if they would have enough brains and enough ability to connect things and be able to speak about it. And, you know, they do understand, many of them. But what they say, those far-right people, they say, if we speak against Jews doing this or that, then we will never get access to radio, we'll never get access to newspapers, we'll never get access to television, we shall never get to parliament, we shall remain forever really poor marginals. But if we fight against Muslim immigration without mentioning Jews even once, then we can get into parliament, we can get into media, then our life could become much, much better.
Yeah, but it's very stupid, you know, because it's like we talked about this last time, for example. We talked about how there was a lot of prominent Jews within the Swedish Democratic Party, right? And there's the support for Israel is way up there on the list, which is like, wait a minute, because again, Barbara Spector, Annette Kahn, all these other people who are like trying to change Europe and been speaking about it, and they claim that the Jews are going to be responsible for making Europe multicultural. Can't they see these? Can't they connect these dots and realize what's going on?
If they will do, if they'll speak about that, they will find themselves out in the cold. And they make, let's say, cynical, cold decision that they will not look into this direction. That's how things are.
Wow.
And in Ukraine, too. In Ukraine, it's a little bit more complicated. Because there are one of the leaders of the, let's say, of the takeover, that is a very wealthy man. His last name is Kolomoisky, and his first name is Igor or Benya, how he's usually called. That is the wealthiest Jewish oligarch in Ukraine. And he's not just, you know, a Jew by passport or Jew by his grandparents or whatever. He is the head of the biggest Jewish community. He is a man who builds the biggest synagogues in Ukraine. He is a man who contributes a lot to welfare of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He is the head of the Jewish European Congress. And he is also one of the strongest people in the new Kiev regime. So it would be also, let's say, it wouldn't be fair for us to say that only Nazis rule. Jewish oligarchs rule.
Well, exactly. That's my point. What I'm trying to get to here is that these nationalist groups are they're pawns on the ground. They're ground troops here. They're not behind the pulling the strings in this regard. What it shows to me is that again, it shows that the forces who want to try to take control of the country are again willing to work with anybody to achieve their goals, and then they will be purged. They will never have a power position within there, you know. So, but my question as well is: do you understand the forces in the Ukraine? The genuine sentiments, I guess, to actually for nationalism, because you don't want to be sandwiched between the West, the US, and NATO on one end, and then you have the Russian forces on the other. And we know that the antagonism between, unfortunately, I would say, because it's sad to see Russian and Ukrainians who are so similar, their brothers and sisters fighting with each other in this regard. But nonetheless, the history there with the Holodomor and all these kinds of events that happened in 59 or was it 56 and all these other events have caused a lot of anguish between the people. So the people in Ukraine must feel that they're sandwiched between these very powerful forces and they just want to be left alone and run their own country, right?
Well, you know, I'm not sure about that. It's in my view, Ukrainians and Russians, it's very difficult even to know where Russians end and where the Ukrainians begin.
Right.
It's again, it's like let's say speaking about independence of Wales or speaking about independence of Skåne. Yes, there are some people who are the original Aborigines of Wales, but they are not all that plentiful in Wales. And the same in Skåne, how many people are, you know, descendants of people of Skåne of old? It's not like that. And Ukraine too. In Ukraine is a huge country nowadays. Why it is so big? It is so big because Vladimir Lenin, the revolutionary who won the revolution of 1917, thought that if a small Ukraine, which is populated mainly by Ukrainians, would be allowed to be a separate republic, it would become very anti-communist because the people over there, they are small peasants or landholders and farmers. And such people, they wouldn't like to go into socialism. That's why he connected this very small part that was the, let's say, original Ukraine with a lot of industrial areas which where there was some small Ukrainian population bordering with Ukraine. In some places there were 8% of Ukrainians, in some places it was 10% of Ukrainians, because such cities as Odessa, as whatever, Donetsk, they had very, very few, Ukrainians. Otherwise, it's basically Russians. And the difference is, again, impossible to know who is Ukrainian, who is Russian.
Right.
It makes sense to speak about people who speak Ukrainian and people who speak Russian. That is as their first language. That is, anyway, some objective, criteria. And in 1991, something like 70% of people of Ukraine spoke Russian as their first language. And now, for 20 years, there is a lot of brainwashing, like Holodomor and all that. All those things are basically inventions of American masters of discourse, as they call them.
So you're saying that there wasn't millions of people killed, the man-made starvation by the Soviets?
Absolutely. It's absolute bullshit. It's absolute nonsense.
Really?
It's total invention, yes. And there are so many books written about it on this subject. There was a famine, yes. And this famine hit Russia proper as much as it hit Ukraine.
Well, it did, exactly. That's right. But wasn't there a time delay on that, a time lag? The reason was because, of course, the Russian troop came in and took all the food because, as we know, the annex or the expropriation of the farms within Russia basically shut down the food production there first, correct? And then you had a lot of starvation in Russia, and then consequently they tried to loot Ukraine from their food supply, and then consequently you had another starvation there. So this is something that swept the whole, North Asian continent almost there, right?
Well, it's not even similar at all. If we go, that is a very separate subject, let's say, to speak about the famine of 1930s, one can do forever. But to make it in very, very simple terms, it goes like that. The peasants did not want or could not produce enough food to feed the cities. They felt that they do not get enough in payment, and they said that we would not sell our whatever we have to feed the cities. Soviet Union of those days had a great difficulty, and there was of rebuilding industry. They had to rebuild industry. In order to rebuild industry, they had to feed industrial workers. Peasants didn't want to give food. The food had to be taken away. The peasants didn't understand that they are going into very, very brutal confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
The confrontation was definitely very brutal, not only in Ukraine, but in Russia proper as well. Eventually, Stalin's point of view was like that. If Russia does not succeed to go through modernization and industry building during the 10 years, the Soviet Union will be destroyed. And you know, he was right, because in 1941, when Hitler attacked Russia, if Stalin would not build industry that was able to turn out tanks and airplanes, Russia would not exist. So he understood correct that it had to be done, it had to be rebuilt things, and they have to use it very fast to move for industry. That means the cities should be fed. And the peasants understood in very, very difficult and very hard way that there is not much to be done. They had to feed cities. That was obviously very brutal, but sometimes the choices of history are very brutal.
So do you consider that this was for the greater good and that this was the right decision to make?
Well, that is, thank God I don't have to make such choices, moral choices from nowadays. Those choices, let's say, are choices of yesterday. But what is definite is that Stalin or anybody else in Soviet Union never thought of doing anything against Ukrainians, because Russians never considered Ukrainians as being something different. That is something that, you know, you can't even think in such terms, and nobody did. Actually, Russia, Soviet Union, was ruled by Ukrainians as much as it was ruled by Russians, or maybe more.
Well, exactly. I mean, the Kievan Rus, right? They were Scandinavian descendants. They set up shop there first, and then later on, that became the, you know, the Rurik dynasties and all that stuff. That's what created Russia, you know?
Yeah, that was anyway a long time ago. But if we speak about the 20th century, also Khrushchev and Brezhnev and Chernenko, all of those people were also Ukrainians. And they ruled Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
In days of Stalin, also almost half of his lieutenants were Ukrainians. So it's not like that at all. And nobody even thought in such terms in 1930s. That was one of the later inventions when they decided they will create this sort of thing. But, you know, there is always a possibility to find this sort of reasons. It's like speaking about potato famine in Ireland,
right.
Or about famine of 1940s in Bengal. Whenever there is a famine, one can always connect it to this or other plans. And sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. About Ukrainians, definitely it's not, because, as I say, Russians do not feel that Ukrainians are sort of separate breed.
Tell me this then. I want to ask you obviously about some of the sources later before we go here, in terms of where I can read more about Holodomor and you know, that this is debunked. I would be very interested in reading more about that and those claims. But before we do that, so you're saying that this kind of sense of separation is something that's a recent creation to get the disconnect between Ukrainians and Russians, who really are their brothers and sisters, but let's create this kind of divide and rule, division between them. Let's have them fight again by proxy, right? So the other forces seeking to control this region can have these brothers and sisters fight with each other. Is that what you're seeing is going on?
Well, almost. Almost, and I'll tell you why almost, up to a point. Nobody thought, even Americans are not that silly that they would believe that Ukrainians and Russians will fight each other, because they won't. You could see that all attempts to move Ukrainian armed forces against pro-Russian areas really failed. They don't want to.
Right.
They don't want to fight. They won't fight. So that is actually a lost case. They don't want to. What they did want, what the Americans wanted, they wanted to inflame European opinion against Russia. They have one very big problem, the Americans, they have. That Europeans who are under American occupation since 1945 feel, why the hell should Americans rule us? Why should Americans control us through the politicians they succeed to install by bribery or by assassinations? So in Europe, there are more and more people who feel that they are fed up with NATO, They are fed up with American control and they want to be free. So in order to stop those thoughts, Americans say, well, look, Russia is tremendously dangerous.
Sure.
It's Red Tooth Tiger.
Yeah.
They now, yeah, they devour Ukraine. So they wanted Russians to move troops into Ukraine.
I see. So as a way of saying, look, they attacked Ukraine first. We have to move. We have to do something, right? Because even look at the state-owned, press in Sweden and the televisions and everything, the way they've been demonizing Putin for years, you know, it's like, it's hilarious. This is like state propaganda, you know, coming straight out to everybody in Sweden to like try to get them riled up and behind some kind of aggression against Putin. It's ridiculous when I watch it.
Exactly. You know, Henry Kissinger is a very wise man. I liked very much what he said. He was recently on a visit to Moscow. He is over 80, so now he can speak his mind without even giving a damn about anything. So he said, before that, he wouldn't probably say such a thing. Now he said, look at Putin. He spent $60 billion on the Olympic Games to show bright, new, modern Russia. And do you think that after that he will begin making trouble in Ukraine to waste all his incredible investment?
Exactly. I mean, it's a good point. And look at the gay issue alone, how that was exaggerated and what a lie that was against Putin again to try to get all these minority groups and these angry grassroots movements involved in the battle against Russia. Same thing. BS.
Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Speaking about it, what is very interesting that I saw that there was a very interesting publication that one of the people who was very active in promoting this anti-gay Russian image was a man who did before the same thing against Palestinians. That is some American Jew called Kirchick. This Kirchick went to Israel, and he made in Israel a lot of fuss that the Palestinians are anti-gay. And then after that, he was promoted to the next degree. He began to speak that Putin is anti-gay.
Really? Wow. Yeah, because it was this one article, I think, in New York Times. And I think it was a Jewish man who wrote that as well. I don't know if it's the same one, but this is where the inception goes back to in terms of the law, right, that they had passed in Russia. And if you actually read the law, you realize that it was nothing of the sort. It was very, very different from what people were keeping, saying about Putin. But nonetheless, it's stuck, right? That's how propaganda works. You can just, you throw out a couple of sound bites and then people repeat it and then that's it. But it's, there's a lot of lies going on here. So this is basically then, if we zoom out a little bit, this is the war against...
I think it is basically a fight for European opinion. That Russians want Europe to be free and to be friendly. To go its own way, but let's say that the American control of Europe will be over. Russia would feel itself more comfortable in the world, which has, as they call it, they speak about multipolarity. In other words, when there are many independent countries.
Yeah.
While Americans prefer to have, one source of sovereignty, and that's themselves.
Now, tell us a little bit more when you say the Americans, tell us a little bit more about the elite. I think it would be good to preface that a little bit and who you see actually is pulling the strings there. Because as usual, whenever there's an elite force pulling the strings, it's not actually the interest of the people in the country, kind of the same way that no one get to make choices anymore in any of these countries. Nothing is democratically decided upon, but the elite goes out and does it anyway. In terms of America, Who's pulling the strings behind the military-industrial complex and all the money being spent on these kinds of propaganda, these agendas that we see?
Yes, that's for sure. That's not in the interests of American people. Obviously not. American people nowadays can't be relied upon even to go to fight. Even in order to fight their wars, the Americans, instead of it, they hire Latin Americans or whoever wants to get a green card, they go to serve in the American military service, and then they go somewhere else. So America, in a way, became a very, very unusual arrangement state where the armed troops are not theirs anymore, where the money doesn't belong to them, But it is still some very powerful artificial setup. Again, it's a little difficult to understand who exactly rules them. There are different ways to count it. Obviously, the Jews play a very important part in this setup, though probably not as much as they would like to think about to have. Maybe Jews would like to have more control, but they do have, you know, quite a lot of obviously control.
You're talking about AIPAC, the foreign policy and everything, how that's being run. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, well, yes. The most important thing is the control over minds. Mind control, that is the thing.
Yeah.
And that is exactly something where Jews are very, very prominent.
Hollywood, the major media outlets. But that's anti-Semitic, so you can't say that, right?
Well, yeah, you can say if one wants. But again, it's, you can also recognize reality. Let's say when the Americans say that Syria is ruled by Alawites, is it anti-Alawite? Well, obviously it's anti-Alawite. But does somebody care if it is anti-Alawite? No, nobody cares. So why kind of to be anti-Jewish is worse than to be anti-Alawite?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, in Syria.
Well, you're Jewish yourself, aren't you, Israel?
Yes.
Yeah. So you can mention that, but I can't. Isn't that the case?
Oh, well. You know, everybody can say that.
That's funny. No, it's very good. So okay. We've kind of gone over here a little bit. I know you're tight for time, Israel, but
yes.
Let's just kind of talk where you see this is going. Alleged that there's some kind of election coming up. They obviously are trying to seek, domination over the, you know, you have to have the right people in place. Otherwise, they'll just keep pushing revolutions within the country until it goes that way. What's the future like here? What do you see, you know, 5, 10 years from now down the road in this particular situation?
Well, I think that the most important recent event in this direction was done somewhere else. That was Putin's signing gas contract in China. You know, the trouble is not local anymore. The trouble is global. We speak about, let's say, struggle against American dominance. And this thing goes all over. Today it's Kiev. Tomorrow it's Beijing. Next day it's Africa. So we can't really look at some certain area and to think that the trouble is local and that it could be solved locally.
Sure.
It's not anymore.
Yeah.
So let's say the American idea was like that, to create antagonism between Europe and Russia. And then to push on Russia by demanding from European states to stop importing Russian gas. Instead of it, let them import much more expensive American gas. In such a way, America, you know, wins twice because sells its gas and gets a lot of money for it, and Russians will find themselves moneyless. And that was obvious. Then they will become much, much more poor, much more humble. That was the American idea. And here Putin goes to China and he signs their $400 billion dollar contract of supplying of gas to China. And that was obviously very, very great attack, very great strike on American plans. Because now, let's say, you can say that Russians expressed in such a way to Europe and to America that if Europe doesn't buy our gas, we shall sell gas to China and forget it, freeze it. You can freeze as much as you want, because there is actually no substitute for Russian gas unless Europe would like to pay much, much more.
Yeah, yeah. So there is a scenario there where they have to kind of, exactly, Europe don't want to enter into that, and neither do Russia. There's like, they're trying to make everyone fight, but that's not really happening here. But how do we, as a last point here then, how do we, do you think, challenge and battle this particular agenda that's been run by the small elite, power-hungry group here that we're talking about? How do we battle and charge against this?
Well, in my view, what your Europeans should do, they should in Europe, they should do what the East Europeans did once upon a time, to get East Europeans got free from the Warsaw Pact. and the Western Europe, all the rest, should now get rid of NATO. Instead of it, every country should become sovereign, run its own policy, yes, think about its own interest, and not to submit to agenda-setting elites from the Atlantic.
Exactly. And I mean, in that regard, then you're kind of back to a non-aggressive nationalism, right, where you have to have your own interest first at hand. And so how do you view what's happening right now with everything of the, you know, multiculturalism? And I mean, this is creating, conflict on the street level. We have mass immigration into Europe and things like that. I see this as a weapon to create destabilization and culture clash, absolutely, culture war. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, I fully agree with you. And again, peaceful nationalism, peaceful cultural nationalism is perfectly all right. one of the strongest nationalist forces in Europe, that is Le Front National in France of Marine Le Pen. She went to Moscow a few days ago, and she fully supports Russian moves. So actually, the nationalist forces in Europe, they say that they can do much more with Russia of Putin than with America of Obama.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, great analysis. Thank you so much, Israel Shamir. Please give us your website so people know where to go, and if there's anything else you have out there that you want to mention, books or whatnot.
Thank you very much. Yes, you can look at www.israelshamir.com. Or you can, or .net, or you can just Google me and you will find it wherever. My favorite American site is counterpunch.org, www.counterpunch.org. That's my favorite site. But basically, there are so many other very good sites. I am quite beyond the left and right partition. I think left is good and right is good. Both of them are good, and they shouldn't fight about it. They should fight against the world hegemony.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, gang up on the real enemy here, people, not on each other. And you raise a good point. I've noticed this as well, actually. I mean, left and right in the sense that we used to know them doesn't exist anymore. And I don't care what someone calls it, as long as it makes sense and it's rational, you've thought it out, you've used your brain to come to the conclusions. I have noticed, though, that it's usually the ideologues on the left that ends up calling me right-wing when there's something that they don't agree with. And I attribute this, for the most part, not only that they are actually stuck in the old dialectic, but they don't understand the argument. They don't take the time to actually set themselves into it, because that can be difficult when you're run completely by your emotions and let that control your life instead of using both your brain and your heart. I think that's a good approach to these kinds of subjects. But before I forget here, let's talk a little bit more about Holodomor and the aspect that you mentioned that this is BS. I really want to look into this. I never take anybody's word for it, but I don't discount it either. I want to go to the source material and find out for myself. So where would I go to read more about this?
Well, not right away, not offhand. I really didn't think about it. Have to look them up.
Okay, well, I'll send you an email about that, and then we can, kind of share that with our audience, because I think more than me are curious to find out about this and actually learn more about that and look into it for themselves, as we should do with all, and I emphasize all, historical events. All right, well, thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thank you.
Please check out some of our related shows that we've linked up on the topics discussed here today. Also, don't miss the 1 hour then that we did with Paul Craig Roberts on the same topic right before this one. We'll be back with more in just a few days. Harry Cooper from Shark Hunters, Don Park, Frank Salter, Gregory Sams, Joseph Atwill, Richard Doland, John Rappaport, and Joseph P. Farrell are some of our upcoming guests. We have our full archives at redeyesmembers.com. Go there to sign up and stream or download all previous shows in full. We have over 850 programs on a myriad of topics. For now, we say thank you for listening. We'll be back in just a few days. Please take it easy, take care, and we'll talk more soon. Bye-bye.